Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, Tempe will place red light cameras at these 14 intersections. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on December 6th. Thinking of running a red light in Tempe? Don't. But if you do, you may want to smile for the cameras. As part of a citywide goal to increase traffic safety, Tempe announced earlier this month that it will install red light cameras at 14 intersections in the first quarter of 2025. If Valley drivers are caught speeding or running red lights by the cameras, they will be issued a traffic ticket. However, they'll only receive a warning in the first month of installation. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, red light cameras can reduce crashes by more than 50%. In Scottsdale, crashes at intersections with cameras have fallen by 65% since their installation, according to Lee Engineering, while overall collisions fell by 23%. To place its cameras, Tempe selected intersections with Tempe selected intersections with at least three serious or fatal crashes over a five-year period. Intersections with the highest crash rates per 10,000 vehicles, and those with the largest disparity between the speed limits and how fast drivers were actually going. Here are the 14 intersections getting cameras, plus their crash data from 2021 to 2023. Baseline Road and Rural Road. This intersection, which has three lanes going in each direction, is bordered by a Chipotle and a Bank of America. Crashes, 32. Suspected serious injuries, 1. Suspected minor injuries, 5. Baseline Road and Mill Avenue. This central Tempe intersection near Kiwanis Park also has three lanes going in each direction. It's bordered by the Milltown Strip Mall, a furniture store, a gas station, and a 7-Eleven. Crashes, 25. Fatal crashes, 2. Suspected serious injuries, 1. Suspected minor injuries, 2. Southern Avenue and Mill Avenue. This intersection is bordered by Yucca Tap Room, an urgent care, a body shop, and a Circle K. Crashes, 38. Suspected serious injuries, 3. Suspected minor injuries, 2. Warner Road and McClintock Drive. This South Tempe intersection has two lanes going in each direction and is outfitted with bike lanes. It's bordered by a Raising Cane's, Bank of America, Take 5 Oil Change, and the Countryside Specialty Shops Strip Mall. Crashes, 41. Suspected minor injuries, 5. Guadalupe Road and McClintock Drive. This central Tempe intersection is bordered by Changing Hands Bookstore and Trader Joe's. Crashes, 38. Suspected minor injuries, 9. University Drive and McClintock Drive. This north Tempe intersection is bordered by a gas station and Sonny's Diner. It's just south of Tempe Marketplace and Tempe Town Lake. Crashes, 80. Fatal crashes, 1. Suspected serious injuries, 1. Suspected minor injuries, 16. Broadway Road and McClintock Drive. This central Tempe intersection is bordered by a gas station, CVS Pharmacy, and a Burger King. Crashes, 70. Suspected serious injuries, 2. Suspected minor injuries, 14. Broadway Road and Rural Road. This central Tempe intersection is surrounded by a Salad and Go, Panda Express, and AT&T store. Crashes, 65. Fatal crashes, 1. Suspected serious injuries, 3. Suspected minor injuries, 7. Elliott Road and Rural Road. This South Tempe intersection is surrounded by a CVS pharmacy, Dollar Tree, Circle K, and the Pollock Southwind Plaza strip mall. Crashes, 30. Suspected minor injuries, 7. Elliott Road and Kyrene Road. This South Tempe intersection has a train track that cuts through the middle. Crashes, 27. Suspected serious injuries, 2. Suspected minor injuries, 3. University Drive and Priest Drive. This North Tempe intersection is surrounded by 2 gas stations, a strip mall, and several fast food joints, including Rally's, Taco Bell, and Subway. Crashes, 76. Suspected serious injuries, 4. Suspected minor injuries, 11. Curry Road and Scottsdale Road. This North Tempe intersection, which is the only one of the group located north of Tempe Town Lake, is surrounded by a boot retail store, a Jack in the Box, and an acai bowl shop. Crashes, 41. Suspected serious injuries, 3. Suspected minor injuries, 4. Rio Salado Parkway and rural/Scottsdale Road. This North Tempe intersection is bordered by ASU's Mountain America Stadium and is just south of Tempe Town Lake. Crashes, 48. Suspected minor injuries, 10. And 48th Street and Broadway Road. This Northwest Tempe intersection is surrounded by 2 gas stations and a strip mall. Crashes, 47. Suspected minor injuries, 3. This next story is brought to us by writer Morgan Fisher and was posted on December 5th. Prep your shocked face. State Senator Wendy Rogers follows neo-Nazis on X. Last week, the Texas Observer unmasked people behind 4 anonymous accounts that spew anti-Semitic rhetoric on X, the Elon Musk-owned social media site formerly known as Twitter. Among the followers of 2 of the accounts is a certain Arizona state senator, extremist Republican Wendy Rogers. As of Thursday morning, Rogers was still following both at the official 1984 and at 9mm_smg. The first was identified by the Observer as 40-year-old Texas-based marketing official Cyan Cruz, who also spreads pro-Hitler messaging and conspiracy theories around Holocaust denialism. The account has nearly 223,000 followers. The second was revealed to be a 42-year-old retired mechanical engineer named Michael Gramer, who identifies on the platform as a white nationalist, posts neo-Nazi rhetoric like 14 words, a code for a slogan coined by the white supremacist David Lane, and Blood and Soil, which is a foundational Nazi slogan. Gramer also discusses his preference for fascism and national socialism over democracy with his roughly 221,000 followers. Rogers isn't the only elected official who is following the accounts. The Observer reported that Republican U.S. Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky also follows 3 of the 4 neo-Nazi accounts. Any association with neo-Nazi ideology by an elected official would normally be a shocking, career-ending event, but that's never been the case for Rogers. She has a large following of her own, with nearly 384,000 followers on X, and caters to them with the same kind of rhetoric. She's also frequently associated herself with extremists and anti-Semites. "Well, knock me over with a feather," posted Robbie Sherwood, communications director for the Arizona House Democrats. Arizona State Senator Wendy Rogers reportedly follows 2 of these exposed neo-Nazi accounts. On Blue Sky, the account Arizona Right Watch wrote, "Of course, white supremacist Arizona State Senator Wendy Rogers is also following multiple accounts named here. Rogers' extremist history. Rogers has a long history of extremist rhetoric and ties. In September, the Flagstaff Republican posted a Nazi rallying cry on X, writing, "Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles," after far-right parties in Germany's government won multiple elections. Those lyrics were banned in Germany after World War II due to Adolf Hitler's use of them to stir up nationalistic sentiment. Rogers has promoted the white supremacist-led Great Replacement Theory, which suggests that there's a conspiracy to displace white Americans with immigrants of color. She also attended a QAnon event in 2021 with three other Republican legislators that featured anti-Semitic imagery. And she appeared alongside white supremacists and neo-Nazis at a Turning Point USA event in Phoenix. In 2022, Rogers delivered a video message to a conference for the white supremacist organization America First Political Action. She called attendees patriots and praised the host of the event, known white nationalist and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes. After Donald Trump's election victory over Kamala Harris last month, Fuentes posted in support of rape by tweeting, "Your body, my choice." I truly respect Nick because he's the most persecuted man in America, Rogers told the audience in 2022. Rogers' Senate colleagues challenged her over her speech at the conference and her support of Fuentes, but she refused to condemn him. Rogers did not immediately respond to Phoenix New Times' request to comment on the Observer's reporting. She has remained active on X's platform, though she hasn't addressed the report there. Instead, she has posted about anything else, including her support of controversial Secretary of Defense pick Pete Hegseth, daylight savings time, President Joe Biden's potential pardons, cryptocurrency, and SpaceX satellites. Levine residents raise stink about stink, push out composting company. This next story was written by T.J. LeHoux and posted on December 3rd. For months, a putrid odor has permeated the streets and houses in a Levine Village neighborhood. Until recently, residents had no idea what was causing the stench. Brian Mosby lives close by and thought it was coming from a nearby junkyard. "You get it in the morning and at night," he said. "It's horrible." Another resident, Rochelle Session, said the smell was the worst at 4 o'clock in the morning, while Daniel Vigil and Max Salcedo felt the malodor peaked in the summer. "Sometimes the smell is so bad you can't even breathe," said Session, who stopped going outside in the morning. "I was like, yo, this is intense." Residents began complaining to municipal authorities roughly 6 months ago, with Vigil saying he was one of the first to lodge a complaint. According to Maricopa County Communications Director Fields Mosley, more than 600 complaints were made about the smell as of Thanksgiving week. Eventually, residents identified the smell's origin, a nearby composting business called Growers Market, which is located near 31st Avenue and Dobbins Road. The company has been incorporated since 1995, according to records kept by the Arizona Corporation Commission, though it's not clear how long it has operated at the Levine location. During a recent visit to the property, excavator vehicles lumbered around heaping piles of organic material. A pungent, sour smell of rotting fruit, already strong around the neighborhood, was overpowering near the facility, with the air so thick you could feel it on your skin. Google reviews of the facility from residents who live nearly a mile and a half away are filled with complaints about the smell. The company rents the space, but not for much longer. In the face of community backlash, the facility will reluctantly leave the area. "We could apply for all kinds of permits, who've chosen not to do that and just to leave, said Growers Market owner Neil Brooks. All we're doing now is processing what's on site to leave. Fines accumulate. The impending shutdown of the composting business is a victory for residents who spent months complaining about the smell it emitted. Initially, it appeared that little could be done. Mosley said the county's air quality and planning and development departments are, quote, continually monitoring the area now, and they haven't found any public health or air quality violations that are within their authority. He added that the county can't regulate odors caused by hydrogen sulfide. But on November 8th, Harold Murko, a hearing officer for the Maricopa County Department of Planning and Zoning, found that property owner Timon Bolton, who leases the land to Brooks, was violating a zoning ordinance by operating the business there. The property did not have an agriculture exemption to operate, Murko wrote, adding that Bolton had not applied for or obtained a special use permit to operate the composting business. That violation resulted in an immediate $750 fine for Bolton and a $75 fine for every day the business is not in compliance. As of Monday, the business was still operating, which means Bolton has racked up more than $2,500 in total fines. The county gave Growers Market until March 10th to either cease operations, apply for rezoning or a special use permit, or prove that the property has obtained agricultural tax classification. I understand that you are all eager for this business to come into compliance, Supervisor Steve Gliardo, whose district includes Levine, said in a press release. Maricopa County is working diligently to address the violations and keep you all informed of the latest updates. Bolton declined to comment when reached by New Times. Pulling out. Growers Market will leave. Brooks said the company will not put up a fight. It has stopped taking incoming composting materials and is preparing to leave the area as soon as possible. He did not say whether the business would set up shop elsewhere. But Brooks and Growers Market will be leaving less than willingly. Brooks is passionate about composting, which diverts organic matter otherwise destined for a landfill and helps recycle it for use as healthy soil. And he believes it's an important process for creating a healthier environment. According to a March interview with 12 News, Brooks said Growers Market had received a $2.4 million grant for composting, though he did not specify who awarded it. Brooks also believes his business has been unfairly targeted by a community that's whipped itself into a frenzy. He said complaints about his business reached a point of hysteria among residents, with some claiming dead bodies and burning fires are on the property. Brooks said that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and regulators found those conspiracy theories to be false. Then I get four people, other neighbors, who say, we don't smell anything. We care about the environment, and we think this is a travesty of justice, Brooks said. I make the mistake of forwarding that to a regulator, and somehow the neighbors got a hold of it and called and threatened the lady that made the comment. Brooks declined to share more information about the woman he said was threatened for supporting his business. Yes, composting stinks, but Brooks insists it smells no worse than many other odors emitted by businesses in the area. Go by our place and smell it. And go by a landfill and smell it, he said. There are four other composters in town. There's about 10 dairies in the area. Go by and smell them. They all smell like Levine, which is an ag community. Brooks could stick it out, apply for a special use permit, and make his case to the community. But if nearby residents feel his business has poisoned the air, Brooks says they've poisoned the discourse about it. He doesn't foresee upset residents ever halting their efforts to shut him down, even if he had a proper permit. I don't have any faith, he said, that I'll be heard. D'Souza admits key claim in debunked 2000 Mules film was bullshit. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on December 2nd. When election conspiracy theorist Dinesh D'Souza released his so-called documentary, 2000 Mules, 2 years ago, most people with decent critical thinking skills recognized it as a slipshod falsity. The film's claims about widespread voter fraud to steal the 2020 election in Arizona and other swing states hardly stood up to scrutiny. Now, D'Souza is forced to agree. Thanks to an ongoing defamation suit against him, the right-wing filmmaker has posted an apology message and admitted to one of the film's crucial flaws. I make this apology not under the terms of a settlement agreement or other duress, but because it is the right thing to do, given what we have now learned, D'Souza said. The film depicts an organized group of mules that D'Souza claimed illegally gathered large amounts of ballots to bring them to voting drop boxes to sway the 2020 election for Joe Biden. While its claims have largely been criticized and debunked, it's received an audience in Arizona and beyond. After the release of 2000 Mules, staff from the organization True the Vote, which provided much of the data for the film, visited Arizona state legislators and other politicians to share their findings at the start of the 2022 legislative session. Those present included now outgoing U.S. Representative Debbie Lesko, Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb, and State Senator Wendy Rogers. While Republican state officials and politicians supported the film upon its release, its narrative wasn't uncontested. In October 2022, the office of then-Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, a Republican, asked the FBI to investigate True the Vote, after the right-wing organization had ignored Brnovich's request to share the documentary's evidence. The evidence, D'Souza now acknowledges, was bad. In an apology posted on November 28th, D'Souza admitted that one basis for the film's claims, the supposed geolocation data and surveillance video of drop boxes, was flawed. The documentary included surveillance footage of a ballot box in downtown Phoenix, where it alleged that mules cast extra ballots. True the Vote claims that 200 people in the Grand Canyon state made an average of 20 ballot deposits each at drop boxes. We recently learned that surveillance videos used in the film may not have actually been correlated with the geolocation data, D'Souza wrote on his website. Defamation suit. However, it doesn't seem like D'Souza is clearing the air out of the goodness of his heart. In 2022, Georgia voter Mark Andrews, who was featured in the documentary, filed a defamation lawsuit against the filmmaker. In the movie, Andrews, with his face blurred, is shown placing ballots into a drop box while a voiceover called his actions a crime. However, what Andrews was doing was perfectly legal, and he wasn't a mule. Per a state investigation, Andrews was legally dropping off the ballots belonging to him and his family members, who all lived at the same address. The clips of Andrews' blurred face were used in promotional materials on other conservative sites, including a show hosted by Phoenix right-wing organizer Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA. I owe this individual, Mark Andrews, an apology, D'Souza wrote in his statement. I now understand that the surveillance videos used in the film were characterized on the basis of inaccurate information provided to me and my team. Others are still waiting for their mea culpas. Outgoing Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Ricker, a centrist Republican who battled election conspiracy theories for 4 years, is one of them. I'm now accepting apologies on this nonsense theory, Ricker wrote on X after a brief hiatus from the platform. And honestly, if at this point you can't admit that you were hoodwinked by this fraud, which doesn't make you a bad person, then maybe consider that you never will, no matter what. Ricker shouldn't hold and probably isn't holding his breath. D'Souza still stands behind his film's larger message, claiming that the team behind the documentary, quote, operated in good faith. Here's a story written by T.J. LaHerue and posted on December 4th. Tempe says it will crack down on unhoused people, worrying advocates. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that municipalities can ban sleeping in public even when a person has nowhere else to go. And in November, Arizona voters passed Proposition 312, which allows people to sue cities for property tax refunds if public nuisance laws such as camping bans aren't enforced. Advocates for the unhoused worried that the result of both of these could be more people unable to escape homelessness. Now, the city of Tempe appears to be committed to making that happen. On Tuesday, Tempe issued a press release announcing that it would be implementing strict enforcement of its urban camping ordinance, specifically citing the passage of Proposition 312 and the Supreme Court's ruling in Grants Pass v. Johnson, which upheld the constitutionality of camping bans. The Grants Pass decision specifically states that citing people for urban camping is not cruel and unusual punishment, the release said. Proposition 312 allows for property owners to apply for a refund from cities and counties for costs related to urban camping if a city does not enforce its ordinances. The ordinance in question is Tempe City Code 2390, which was passed in 1997 and updated in 2018. It bars people from using public property as housing. This includes pitching tents or building shelters in places such as city parks, preserves, alleys, bus stops, schools, or rights of way, the city's release said. It also bans activities such as making fires, storing personal belongings in public spaces, and laying down bedding for sleeping. In effect, it outlaws most of the things unhoused people do to survive. The city said anyone who violates the ordinance will be offered outreach services and given a warning that urban camping is not allowed in the city of Tempe public spaces. However, after that, violators will be cited with a Class 1 misdemeanor, which is punishable by a fine of up to $2,500 or up to 6 months imprisonment. It is hoped that those in need of assistance will take the opportunity to get help, the city's release said. It was a telling use of passive voice. After all, the city's critics say Tempe isn't doing much to provide that help. Very cynical. On the housing and shelter section of its website, Tempe pats itself on the back for its approach to helping its unhoused residents. Tempe is known for its progressive response to addressing homelessness, the site reads. Many who work with the unhoused in Tempe scoff at that notion. Fund for Empowerment founder Elizabeth Venable says Tempe has done little to actually help anyone experiencing homelessness. Historically, the city of Tempe has kind of kicked the can along on addressing homelessness by relying on other cities to take the lion's share of the burden of actually providing services, Venable said. For many years, there were zero shelters in Tempe. Now, there is one city-run shelter, Sue's Espacio, a 40-room former hotel that the city purchased and converted for the purpose in 2021. This year, the city purchased a second property that will add another 60 rooms for the unhoused, though it has yet to open. But even by Tempe's own metrics, it is failing badly at housing the homeless. Its statistical database for homelessness outreach shows that this year, a paltry 7% of interactions with unhoused people resulted in them getting housing. As for other services the city might offer, Venable feels that those don't meet the needs of the problem. It is very important whether or not outreach services have the capacity to help and what their budget is, Venable said. Otherwise, the line about, "We hope they accept help," is total crap. Often, it's just detox or mental health, and the majority of people don't qualify. So if they are telling people to accept services that either don't exist or for which there are exclusion factors, such as having to have been addicted to drugs as a qualifier for receiving services, then the statement is very cynical. Ron Tapscott, who has worked to feed the homeless and help them get key services, claimed that the city works hard to deny services. He alleged that Tempe staffers had used the Homeless Management Information System, which tracks interactions with unhoused people, to identify where people had received services elsewhere in the valley, in order to justify denying those same services in Tempe. Tapscott said he knew of one man Tempe turned away because he had accepted services in Scottsdale just a month before. A Tempe spokesperson did not immediately respond to a question about Tapscott's allegation. There is a further demonstration that the city is absolutely lacking any moral courage or any decisive action to protect this endangered population, Tapscott said, of the camping ban enforcement. Disgusting. It's not clear why the city chose Tuesday to broadcast its intention to crack down, or how different the enforcement will be going forward. Austin Davis, who has been targeted by the city for his efforts to feed the unhoused in Tempe Parks, noted that the city has been arresting and jailing homeless people all year. That has included Davis. Earlier this year, Davis was jailed for trespassing in a city park. He's also now barred from Tempe Parks until early 2026, as part of a plea deal he accepted for hosting feedings in Tempe Parks in violation of the city's special permits ordinance. It's not like this is anything new, but it's like they're emboldened now by the Grants Pass decision, Davis said. They're putting legality and this law, even if it's harming people, above our moral standards as humans. I think it's disgusting. I'm worried about everyone experiencing homelessness. The chorus of critics also includes Lauren Kuby, the former vice mayor of Tempe, who won election this year to the Arizona Senate, where she will represent a district that includes North and Central Tempe. Kuby has helped to continue Davis's feedings while he's been on probation. Just because a hardened SCOTUS deems that citing vulnerable people for urban camping is not cruel and unusual punishment, doesn't mean that a compassionate city shouldn't adopt a higher moral and ethical standard, Kuby said via text message. We can't resolve the homelessness crisis by criminalizing the homeless. A fine of $2,500 won't help a family in dire need of housing. Timothy Rawls wrote this next story, posted on December 6th. Black Theater Troupe's Black Nativity returns for 39th year. Black Theater Troupe's 39th annual production of Langston Hughes' Black Nativity opens on Friday, February 6th. Written by the poet and playwright in 1961, it visually and musically subverted American societal norms and American Christian beliefs about the birth of Jesus Christ, which mostly portrayed him as Caucasian. Using jazz and gospel music, the first half of Black Nativity retells the biblical story and is adapted directly from Hughes' play. The second half offers a unique, vibrant, and rousing musical experience that mixes culture, community, and gospel music into a joyous celebration of the season. Although Black Nativity is a work for everyone, Its production is a place where the African-American community can come together to celebrate their culture through music and artistic creativity. As you will find out, that is important. It helps develop their empowering stories, often ignored by the mainstream. This is their 55th season as a troupe. Phoenix New Times recently spoke with Tony Wheaton, director of Black Nativity, ahead of the show's 2024 debut. Phoenix New Times. How many years has Black Nativity been running in Arizona? Tony Wheaton. 2024 is the 39th year Black Theater Troupe has produced Black Nativity. Black Theater Troupe is 54 years old. How many people are in the troupe? For Black Nativity, there are 34 casts and 6 musicians, and then an additional 12 in production. Why is this particular production so important to you? I first got involved with Black Theater Troupe when I performed in Black Nativity as a teenager. From there, I became more involved. I was cast in The Wiz, then started work with the company behind the scenes, where I found my passion, producing and directing. Last year, I made my debut directing Black Nativity, which was really well received, so to be asked to return is like coming full circle. What can audiences expect from this year's production? This year, we have a younger cast and new, fresh songs, but most importantly, we're using phrasings and stylings that are more relevant to younger gospel singers of today. So audiences will experience the first act with its traditional gospel songs, and then, combined with the second act, they will see how gospel has contemporized over the years. Black Theater Troupe Executive Director David J. Hemphill has said that this show offers a unique perspective on the Nativity story. Historically, this story has been told from a Caucasian angle, but in the part of the world where it takes place, people were of color. How do you feel about people thinking this story is diverse rather than historically accurate? We hope that when people see our version of the Nativity story, it will prompt them to explore and research to find the true origins of the Nativity story. Black Nativity provokes this question, and we hope it helps people more easily understand the origins of where the story came from. I've been told that the second half of the production is unique. How so? Each year, Black Nativity is different. The first act is always the Nativity story as written by Langston Hughes. His song play with traditional gospel stylings and traditional gospel songs. Then, the second act is a contemporary concert. All of the performers in the second act are well-known local gospel artists, so when the production is being planned and put together, our musical director, Brenda Hankins, and I look at the cast and work together to select the special songs that those singers are known for, their showpieces. Black Nativity shows the evolution of gospel music and the African-American church. Why is Black theater so important to the community? Black theater is important to the community in many ways. For the audience, while all of the stories we tell are universal, with themes that are recognizable to people of all backgrounds, it's important for people to know the significance of African-American culture and see things through the lens of the Black experience. For me personally, I feel that Black Theater Troupe offers people opportunities that wouldn't be possible in other places. Like, I don't think I would have ever gotten the opportunity to be a director because I had no prior experience directing. But being part of the Black Theater Troupe, I was given the freedom to learn, observe, and grow behind the scenes. I had the ability to see what directing was all about, shadow other directors, work with Mr. David, and then I was given the opportunity to actually direct. And now, here I am. I'm directing and producing more. I've been nominated for a directing award, and I'm returning to direct this show. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock.